Good day, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 24th, 2002, during 2002 Living in Liturgy. This session is Supporting Leaders of Congregational Prayer, How to Empower Lay Assisting Ministers for Leadership. This will be led by Pastor Ben Stewart. You can find this in the Holden Library or order this under the heading LIVLIT 2002-7. Let's see what he has to say.
My name is Ben Stewart, and I get to serve here at Holden as village pastor. And in case you want to get out the door, this is the wrong place. This is the place to talk about training assisting ministers in your parish and empowering them to be leaders of the people in worship. Good. Nobody else. I'm surprised people aren't just poo. There's been so much great singing and thinking. You are poo. Yeah. But if somebody said it's coffee that was keeping them keeping their eyes open. So, phew. We get a chance here to be in community together throughout the week, and we commit to being in worship together every night and on Sundays as well. So we have a great kind of captive audience from which to draw assisting ministers. So I hope some of the experience that we've had here can be valuable for some of you who are doing this, maybe with some tougher things to do. Just so I can get kind of a sense of where you're coming from, what's drawing you here, maybe a few of you could just kind of call out where you're from and what brought you to this session. What's your assisting minister program like now? Do you have one? What would you like out of a session on assisting ministers?
I'll start. I'm Lois Belzer from Central in Yakima. We have a program where we train ministers as needed. I went through the training 18 years ago. Probably need to go back through it again because I don't feel real comfortable, even though I do it fairly often.
Okay. So you are an assisting minister yourself. Okay, great.
I'm Carolyn Olsen. I'm from Kendrick, Idaho. We do not have a program. There has been at the church in the past, but no one seems especially anxious to fill that role. So I'd like to start.
Okay.
Karen McCrow from Spokane, Washington. Right now we don't have a lay assistant program. We have people who lay assist. I think I'm the only one who has actually had any training. Our organist who directs the music program at Messiah comes from a fundamentalist background, and if he needs somebody, he just says, "Oh, will you go up and do it?" And I mean, they'll go sit down in the middle of a prayer. They just kind of have their own idea of how it's done. And so I'm just looking for nice ways to bring about. Let's do some training here.
Okay, great. I'm
Kathy Fitzgerald. I'm from Vancouver, Washington, and I serve as a cantor and lay assistant in my home parish. I'm also a member of the Southwest Washington Synod's community of lay ministers. And so I'm here for two reasons. One is because we don't really have a program at church, but we have trained cantors, and it's pretty much the same half dozen people have been doing it forever, and that's, fine. It'd be nice to expand that and find ways to do that. The other thing is looking for ways of talking with that community about how to help them in their congregations feel empowered to do the ministry they've been called to do.
That sounds like I'm getting a sense there may be a common thread there. Are many of the programs that you experience either having very little assisting minister training, or the training that there is, it's kind of sing on this note and then say this prayer and then stand here? I'm seeing some nods. No?
They don't even get the stand here part of it.
Okay. Cool. Things that are different than that?
Training people that think they don't need training.
Hi, I'm Carol from Northfield in Minnesota. And we organized our cadre of assisting ministers maybe 6 years ago. Six or seven years ago, you might say, and I was in that first group, and we had this gathering, and I thought, this is terrific, because we're going to get some training. And the training consisted of, you know, learn the liturgy if you need help with that, the singing liturgy. If you need help with that, we can do that. And write the prayers of the day and say and pray them. And I think I was probably the only one in the group who was willing to do that. And so if the person was not willing to do it, there would be prepared prayers for them. But, I mean, there was no guidance for that at all. And I'm very comfortable doing it. And interestingly enough, I get a lot of comments when I do prayers. Mine are different from what the pastor prepares by quite a stretch. And I have no idea how to train anybody to do that, but I could use some help, and I'd be willing to try if in fact we could get the group together and that's a need that somebody else sees. So.
Great.
I think prayers of the church are probably, for our particular congregation, one of the most central and focused parts of the service, that they follow right after the Eucharist and right before the final blessing. And it's quiet, and we can be as slow as we want to with it, even though we're going overtime most of the time. And people comment a lot about how meaningful, I guess, or how well heard those prayers are. Not just mine, I mean everybody's, but I mean, so it's an important part of the service to our congregation. And I think there are a lot of people who don't really feel equipped to do it.
Okay. Other things that sound different kind of experiences in your home parish that you're in.
We haven't had another training session, by the way, since that first one 7 years ago.
Okay.
I'm Pat Kohlberg, and I'm from Rochester. We have a small church. We have lay assistants. They don't have any training. They're asked to be a lay assistant if they can sing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we have four. We run the gamut from one who performs. I'd like to know how to get her to quit performing and... It's a performance. Mm-hmm. To the one who is embarrassed to put the robe on, and he seems embarrassed to be there. So we really need training. It's just they're kind of thrown at it. Like, you know, to stop the performing.
Yeah. Karen?
I was just going to say, I'm Karen Miller from Phoenix, Arizona, and we have a cadre of 18 to 20 right now of assisting ministers, and they range from, we have one junior high student up through adults, those of us that do it, because we have a variety of worship liturgies that we use. Some of them are more comfortable doing others, and I do the scheduling for all of that based kind of on their desires and that sort of thing. We have had training. We could use additional training just because we have some that are stronger than others, but they're all willing. And I was going to say the prayers of the day seem to be the one issue that our younger members struggle more with than our older members. But we try to help them with that. There's several of them that are willing to sit down with them, you know, but we make sure that they also get the text a week or two in advance.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. Donna.
I'm Donna. We train once a year, and in our confirmation program, all of our confirmation students, 7th through 10th grade, are required to somehow participate in worship leadership. And it's typically the 10th graders who, at first, start being assisting ministers, and then they continue on through high school. But we also range from very young to 60, 70-year-olds who are assisting ministers. Some sing, some don't sing. When they choose not to sing the liturgy, then a cantor will sing it.
Wow.
Do they write the prayers?
They write the prayers.
Mm-hmm. Wow, so it sounds like some of us have pretty elaborate and large cadres of assisting ministers, and some of us don't have any. So there's a bit of a broad floor here. But what I'd like to do is first kind of introduce the theology and thinking behind the way we do it here, and then take you through, in about a half an hour, kind of the way we train. We give people about 5 hours of initial training before they ever do it, and then kind of constant feedback throughout after they begin assisting ministry. But first, I want to do something before we get too settled in. Why don't you stand up? And it's a little tighter, so if you can spread out a little bit, you need a partner. Everybody needs to pair up with one person. Okay, pair up. Okay. We have partners? Anybody left over? Perfect. Yes?
Far.
Okay. I may have to do this. I don't know if I can do this, and maybe you can.
Can three of us?
Yeah, let's try three. Okay. So face your partner.
Out of my legs.
Y'all are going to have to kind of... you guys are going to have to figure this out. But I think you can figure out a way. You're going to need A and B, okay? So one of you needs to be A, one of you needs to be B. I'm going to identify those people. Person A... What person B is going to do is just mirror you. You're going to be facing each other, and just start moving.
Whatever
you'd like to do, be respectful of your partner. Gentle, nice. Gently and carefully, kind of turning off your brain, just becoming kind of unified as much as you can, paralleling this person. Now, person B, your turn to begin to read this person. Probably not representing anything, just gentle, nice movements. Okay, now person A again.
Your turn.
You two need to stop hamming it up. Okay. Person A again. Person B. Now. Okay. What I'm going to do now, keep going. Just very gently and slowly. Just whatever feels good to your body.
Okay.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to start switching you back and forth. More quickly and more quickly, and try very gently, just as one set of people, to keep moving together, okay? So there's no rough break, okay? And then after that, I'm going to shout out, follow the follower.
No, I can't.
And when I shout, follow the follower, I want you to turn you're not thinking, I don't want you to think, but there will be no follower, but keep moving. There'll be no leader, there'll be no follower, but keep going, okay? You don't have to think about it. Okay, person A. Person A, you're leading. Just smooth movements. Keep moving. Now, person B. Now, person A. And B. And A. Don't think. Just keep moving. Person A. B. A. B. Don't think. A. B, A, B, A. Don't think, just keep moving. Follow the follower.
It's me.
Follow the follower.
Don't think, just nobody's leading, nobody's following.
That's true.
Okay, let's stop. Okay. I want you to tell me now. We're going to reflect on this experience in just a little bit. Tell me when you have been able to pray through, when a worship leader has helped you pray, how have they done it? What's their presence like as a leader of the assembly? You can just shout out. What are their characteristics?
You mean what they do or who they are?
What they do.
What they do.
Humble.
Speak quietly. Speak slowly. Mm-hmm. Allow for time to think. Don't rush anything.
A specific invitation to come join.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's emotion involved.
Yeah, there's emotion involved.
It's not in a monotone.
Feels very genuine.
It feels genuine.
There's a confidence that provides for a safe environment.
Right. You don't feel manipulated by
it. You don't feel manipulated.
No. Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily prepared.
Intentional. They're there for the community. They're present with the community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any other things? I think I heard two themes in there, at least that I can divide them into. Is one is the person kind of a sense of presence, confidence, being authentic to who they are, but also they're not manipulated. They're not they're present to the community. They're very much aware of this community that they're serving, and it's not a way. The person's personal presence isn't something that they foist on the other. They're always very much aware of what the assembly is doing. This follow the follower exercise, I think, it's hard to do with a big group like this because, you know, people start playing air guitar and stuff like that. But in smaller groups, you can often get people to do this thing where you're going back and forth and there's one leading and then suddenly there isn't anybody leading and yet there's both action going on. And that's the model we try to use here with worship assistants, that they are being faithful to this community. There's some kind of dynamic relationship to the community that they're serving. While they come ideally prepared, certainly not always fully prepared for what might happen, but they want to be always gauging where the assembly is, and yet they also are leading at the same time. And something was happening. Somehow this follow the follower was working. There was movement happening. But that's what we try to have happen with our assisting ministers, to give them a sense of being faithful to what's going on out there in the assembly. I'm going to take you through now the way we try to set up this relationship so that there's this real kind of I-thou relationship to the congregation. And part of this whole thing is, I mean, many of you I'm sure know this, the assisting minister means they're assisting who or what?
The minister.
The minister.
The congregation.
Yes, the congregation. Yeah, and that's one of the biggest things that we try to turn is to get them away from the kind of personal assistant to the pastor mindset and free them so that they're not following, but they are serving the people. And when they get that, they've got it. You know, there's a confidence and a presence.
Sometimes the pastor needs to be disabused of that.
Yes. So, three ways that we approach that to get them to be assisting the people of God is a grounding in not just the following the rubrics, sing this, say this, but a lot of what the team has been talking about these last couple days is what is the shape of the liturgy? What is this great dance in the big picture that we're doing when we come together on Sunday? Grounding and then preparation, both long-term and for every week. And then kind of doing the practices, really then the real fine, how to speak, how to hold your body, what are some practical hints. So I've got three pages, and I know some people didn't get these when they came in. I'll do a sheet that we can put out here when you leave. If you'd like these things, you can sign up. But for now, if you could share.
I have an X here.
There's an X for someone?
Back there.
Can you guys have to share back here? And also the sign-up sheet. We can get more of these printed out. Or actually, why don't you look at the sign-up sheet? I'll print out a bunch more and put them on the table over there tomorrow. Okay. what we do in our first session is we gather together and we do a lot. We do this follow. We do some other kind of theater game stuff to give them a sense of how their body relates to other people and how it kind of communicates back and forth. And then we talk about kind of the deep shape of liturgy. And this one I've done, it's kind of a giveaway here, gathering, word, meal, sending. That's basically what you want to give people a sense of, is whether you're doing LBW or with one voice or some other liturgy. That's the shape of the Sunday gathering. So if you know this reading from Nehemiah, a lot of this is from, if you don't know Gordon Lathrop's Holy People and Holy Things, these are just amazing books to talk about the shape of the liturgy. I don't see many heads back, so I won't read this whole thing, but it's an amazing reading. So we ask the question, what are we actually doing on Sunday? Put away the green book, put away your worship resources, and say, what happens in there? And so this is the way we talk about it first, is we read this through. And it's a wonderful reading. It's funny to read together, too. The whole assembly was 42,360, besides the male. And then it goes through donkeys and mules and horses, and they number how many. And they all gather. We do a little Bible study on this as well. The problem that's happening in Nehemiah is that the people have come back from exile, and they're ready to repopulate the holy city, to become God's holy people and God's holy city again. But there's been all this kind of pollution of the people out in exile. And how do we re-enter? And so they begin this great service that is going to be the creation of the recreation, remembering of God's holy people. So there's connections already to what happens in the Eucharist. So they all gather, all these people and all their stuff, and they all gather outside the water gate. Not the hotel in D.C., but the water gate outside the city wall, which, of course, to Christians, is going to bring up baptism. Mm-hmm. We gather there at the font. That's the place where we begin, bring all our stuff. So then they tell the scribe Ezra to bring the book of the law of Moses, which they hadn't heard, in the holy city for so long. And so they read, and then everyone helps give interpretation to this. And where's this wonderful quote? They pray and they come down here. When do they start crying here?
Verse 9.
Yeah. And Nehemiah, who was the governor, who taught the people, said to all people, "This is the day holy to the living one, your God. Do not mourn or weep. For all the people wept when they heard the words of the law." The law did its thing like a living and active sword.
Is the living one God's name there?
Yeah, that's the way it's Gail Ramshaw's suggested translation. And so that they hear law, that they hear this word of encouragement, they hear the gospel, and then look what they're sent to do here. Go eat the fat and drink sweet wine. So we have a gathering, we have this service of the word in which everyone helps in interpreting the word, and speaking the gospel after the law has been heard. And then they have the funeral, fat and sweet wine. And then, the last little half a sentence there, send portions and make great rejoicing because they had understood the words that were declared to them. So, the holy city has been repopulated. This gathering has been brought into the center of the city. They eat this wonderful meal, but the meal is never complete until the boundary is broken and they're sent back out, which is always what Christian liturgy is about, the image of strong center, open door. Brought back to the center and then sent back out. The gathering always has to be broken because Jesus is always on the outside of wherever we draw our circles. So you get that? I mean, this is not a claim that the Eucharistic liturgy is in the Old Testament or something, but it's beginning to get a sense of, I know the story of what happens on Sunday. And so this gives people a great sense of confidence when you try a new liturgy, or even when you're doing the liturgy that you've done for 12 years. I know the deep pattern behind that. I understand this. So I'm not going to get flustered if I say the wrong word, because I really know what this is about. So we do this two other times. We take the text from Acts, which is a little it's a little rougher. It's not quite the whole Eucharistic rite, but you can see it all in there. It's Day of Pentecost. Peter's preaching this great sermon. All these non-Christians are gathered and saying, oh, what should we do? What should we do? Be baptized. And so that's the way they're entering the church. They devote themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship, basically the word and the gathering, and to the breaking of bread and the prayers, to the meal. And then it also says in that final paper, they distribute the proceeds to all as any have need. It's a sending rite, a sense of sending what has been received. And then, of course, Justin Martyr, which Dan alluded to in his talk the first night, this amazing... Do people know this, the Justin Martyr thing? Yeah, just a beautiful rendition of what we do on Sunday. So for our first session, for an hour and a half, basically we talk about what it means to be a minister and then what is the great dance that we are doing in the Eucharist. It helps at the end of it. Sometimes I'll bring out, you know, the LBW and say, see, here it is. But I tend not even to use any of that stuff at the beginning just because getting the big picture first before all the details I think can be helpful. Any questions on this one? This is kind of the most broad, nebulous thing.
What would it be appropriate to go to 1 Corinthians 11 and, you know, here's what we received and what passed on and so forth? Mm-hmm. There's also that context where they've been using that.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that would I mean, I'm trying to think if there would be, but my point here to do was to kind of break these up into paragraphs so they could see the order, yeah. You know, the great gathering, word, meal, sending. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to, that passage could certainly be used to give a sense of, look, this has been handed on. Yeah.
Can I just say, you're talking about the great dance, and I had the opportunity to listen to a person who was also talking about the great dance that Christ does with us in our worship, and she was stressing how he seeks out the wallflower, the person who is not being invited into the dance by the boy across the room, you know, and... I think as lay assistants, that's also important for us to seek out the wallflowers and bring them into the worship experience.
Yeah. And I think that's part of that, being faithful to the people who are gathered there, you know, and seeking out something's being left out here, someone's being excluded. Okay, here's a lot of stuff on this next one. We do the next session on preparing. And this is exactly, you're looking at what I give to the people. And I'm not going to go through this whole thing here because I want to talk a little bit more about the Eucharist planning session that I think is the most important thing, an ongoing way that empowers our assistant ministers. Tell me, you know, that basically as you're thinking about the service, we read from two books, the famous thing from Karl Barth. You read from the Bible, and you read from today's newspaper. We want to make sure we're paying attention both to the text and to what's happening in the world. It sounds pretty obvious to many of us who've like been trained. Like we know Karl Barth's counsel on that. But so often, I remember from the parish, luckily we don't have that problem here because everybody has to be in church. All these other concerns come up. You know, well, what will outsiders think of this? And what if our old timers don't like what we're doing in worship? And to bring this always back to the Word of God and what's happening in the world, who's being excluded, where is Christ moving, then the other questions will fall into place. So I usually have them come to a text study on the kind of a exegetical thing, study the lectionary text, and then they can take the text that they'll pray, that they will speak in the Eucharist, and I encourage them to pray them at home throughout the week, to begin to be ready to speak those for the congregation when we get to the Eucharist. I want to talk a little bit about this next thing, this Eucharist planning session, which is just, I think, one of the richest things that we get to do here. Every week before a Eucharist, we gather the presider and the preacher and the assisting minister, the sacristan, usually some dancers, and perhaps an artist, and the musicians. And we meet around the table, and sometimes the hardest thing is to convince people that this is not a Bible study where we're trying to get to, like, the answer or the moral of the story. But we simply read first the first reading, and then just talk about images that we hear in there. What's catching your ear? And then we begin together to kind of, we use this image of turning this multifaceted jewel around, not trying to come to any conclusion. We're expanding this text. Where might it lead us? Not coming to conclusions about what we're going to do, first of all. And we do that for each reading. And just amazing, beautiful things come out of that. Most importantly, I think that when we come to the Eucharist, it's enriched all of our prayer. It's helped us plan our sermons, helped us plan, you know, the music. But there's the sense among all who are leading the worship that we know why we're there, and we're excited to hear these. Oh, that's right. The other people who come to those are the people who are going to read the readings in the Sunday Assembly. So when they read, they've got this sense of, wow, I've been thinking about this all week, and now I'm ready to speak it. Other people, are you doing this? I know some people do this stuff. And that form also, this is, I think, kind of an ongoing, you can think of it as preparation, but it's a great place for feedback. Once we've gone around the block a few times together, one of the dancers might say, well, you know, I think I want to do that thing that we did 6 weeks ago when I bring the book in and do those cartwheels. And somebody might say, you know, that was not prayerful for me, you know. And it becomes this place where we set up trust with each other. And some people who might not write prayers so well, we begin to develop trust, and we can say, this, when you did this, it was helpful for me, but this part wasn't so much. But it really, it takes a commitment, but it really begins to build a sense of excitement among our worship leaders here. And I think the congregation has a sense of trust, knowing that we've been working on it all week, and if something that flops, they know we tried. Any questions about that? Because I don't feel like I'm explaining it very well, but I've just been so amazed at the wisdom that can come out of a group gathered together. Douglas John Hall has this thing that, like, we're not trying to understand the text, we're trying to stand under them, and just kind of this sense of awe about opening the Word of God together, kind of like the Annie Dillard reading, you know. Just, do we dare try to bring these texts, you know, and open them and speak to them and respond to them in worship? And we do together. You know,
you do that, like, what day of the week usually?
Often on a Wednesday, sometimes on Tuesdays. I know we can do things a little bit easier, right? Because then after that, when we actually do, we don't do, like, what hymn are you going to sing and what kind of dance are you going to do for sure. But after that point, you know, there's about a 200-yard radius that we know where people are going to be. We're always going to talk to the carpenter shop.
Because in some of the worship planning, some of the people involved, for example, the musician, you know, they want to know the music stuff like a month in advance.
Yeah. I think it could be done that far ahead of time. There's not that sense of it. I don't know.
Would it be possible to do, thinking about people's time constraints and how hard it is to get the necessary people pulled together for meetings, would it be possible to do more than 1 week at a planning session, so that weekly, you could meet every other week, or even,
but you have different players. You have different players, though.
That's true.
I find when we do our hard work in there, we're often pooped too at the end of one of these things.
Yeah.
But we have an ideal situation.
Yes, yes,
I mean, people don't have much in the way of outside commitments. They're here. They're captive. I mean, what else do they have to do?
No soccer schedule in the evening.
Yeah. No kids.
No TV.
No TV.
Yes, one service. I don't. I mean, I am so thrilled with this that it's going to have to be embodied wherever I am next. It's made me, one of the challenges for me, I don't know, other people probably aren't as naturally a controlling person as I am, but that's been one of my spiritual disciplines, has been to let go of this stuff in these meetings and let people have their kind of whacked out ideas and allow the congregation to give good feedback. And I've been surprised by how wonderful things can come out of these.
Something we've been trying to do, sort of fits in with the assisting minister role. Well, one, we have trouble getting anybody to be willing to do it because most people are Scandinavian and they don't want to get up there, and they're from a tradition where it was just the pastor up there, not a layperson. Mm-hmm. Or they don't think they can sing, and so they won't get up. But we've been trying to get people more involved in the planning of the service itself, choosing hymns, choosing a theme, choosing the prayers. We have piles of material, but we have a really hard time getting anyone who's willing to take ownership of that. And I think it reflects in having trouble getting people to acolyte or to assist. We have this mindset in our congregation, which is an older congregation, of they don't feel like that's their proper role. Their proper role is to sit like a lump in the pew and move their lips and maybe sing. So it becomes really hard to get people in our congregation to have enough ownership, comfort in ownership of the service, to be willing to step forward and maybe change it or make a suggestion. Or
yeah, little steps, I think.
Yeah,
it's real difficult.
Idea for that?
I was going to say, when we first started with our cadre, we opened it up. Very few people showed up. A couple of choir people. So we specifically sat down, the choir directors and the ministers and a few other leaders, and we identified people that we thought would do a really good job. And then we went and specifically asked them if they would be willing to take a little training and see if they'd be willing to do this. And that's how we've gotten to the point where we're at.
And we've done a little bit of that, but unfortunately we have so many people who feel like that's not something that they can do. I don't know anything about music. I couldn't possibly have an opinion about what to sing. And yet when we have our all-summer Pentecost, the people pick the hymns, and we get this amazing variety of things. So it's just trying to translate that into, yes, you can do that. No, you don't have to have any special training, liturgical training, to come and do this planning session. We will show you the things and say, here are 14 hymns that are suggested. What three do you want, you feel, hold together? And those of us do it have wonderful time. We're exhausted. I could relate to that. We'll try to do an entire season, and generally in one meeting if we can get through it, depending on the length of the season. But we have the most wonderful time, and then if you can get someone new involved, then they really feel more like of an ownership and a part of that community. But it's really hard to get people to trust in their own ability to have an opinion.
Yeah, and there's a I heard there's some rubric in the Eastern Church that said for like new pastors that they've got like these 3.5 hour long, like, somebody said, like the liturgy and everything, perfect liturgies.
And you stand through the whole thing.
Yes, but there's this, apparently some counsel that priests get just before they're ordained is that if you find yourself coming to the end of the liturgy and you have not yet made a mistake, make one. And I like that sense of, this is real, this is human, this is not about doing this perfectly, but we're here together.
That's the hang-up a lot of people have in our congregation. They're afraid that they'll make a mistake. Mm-hmm. No, we have one guy who will be the assisting minister, but he will just almost always refuse to sing the liturgy because I'm not a professional musician. I can't possibly sing that. Well, yes, you can, and we've heard you do it. And we constantly are saying, yes, you don't have to be perfect. No, that's not the point.
The first time I did it, I threw up beforehand.
Yeah. I can relate with the woman who talked about what you do when you get into it and you realize you're on the wrong note. Done that. Been there.
I just want to make an observation. It just seems to me like in church life that this is not limited to getting people to be assisted in worship. Mm-hmm. It's a discipleship issue. Mm-hmm. Getting people to take ownership mm-hmm. of their faith and what it means, mm-hmm. whether it's assisting in worship or something else. So it's a more general issue, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the things that I've really gained here at Holden, especially in the winter, is an appreciation for how much, in some senses, it's cost me. I think Dan Erlanger might have been talking about my seminary when he talked about going there with the brass and the organ and all the stuff that's done very well. And for me to let go of my image of what I think this ought to be like, that's been an important part, I think, of people then responding to a sense of call, a sense of discipleship, that, oh yeah, okay, now this community looks like something I can help out with. I don't know that we could ever do that at Holden if we just had the chairs that all faced front. Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. I think that may be the most dramatic thing that shapes us here is sitting in the round for every worship service. We've never, since I've been here for 2 years, ever sat in just all facing one direction, and it's almost incomprehensible. People would like walk out or something.
I don't know if I'm going to phrase this right, so if anybody else is in the same kind of situation, please help me out. What I'm looking for now is how I begin to help empower my congregation to shift the paradigm that says the pastor is the control person, is the one who makes the decisions, and how do we begin to change his paradigm and make it okay for him to let go of some of that, to allow ministry and people called into worship imagination or worship leadership or whatever you want to call it. How do you make that empowerment start?
Send him on a 6-month sabbatical.
You know, he went on one and it didn't change him, darn. I mean, it's...
He came back.
I've got...
And we have wonderful worship, but I cannot even imagine what you're saying, what you're talking about, what this whole... I cannot even imagine.
But it's both, that in your situation, you're saying both pastor feels this kind of need to be somehow in charge of it, but it's also, in general, the congregation feels the pastor needs to do that.
Pardon me? The last part.
The congregation also feels the same way.
But I think that's because that's what he's taught us.
Well, I can say
I really do.
Well, it could be, except that apparently it takes an awful long time for some congregations to, even when they have pastors who don't feel that way, and they keep inviting and encouraging and asking and so forth, to change them up.
Do you have a comment?
Well, and I have a question, because we're on the other end. We just had a pastor who worked for 13 years to get us to see ourselves as lay ministers and as the body of Christ. So now we're in the call process, and we've been functioning, and we've been doing, you know, the ministry. And now I'm worried about how do we make sure that we convey to the person we're calling, you know, we want to be in partnership with you, but how do we do... Like, who's in charge? I mean, all those issues. So if anybody has any resources.
I think there's a wonderful resource to think about this, and it's actually the installation rite of a pastor. Mm-hmm. When you maybe your pastor needs to be reinstalled. it's this wonderful thing. This is in the Lutheran rite, so I apologize to those of you who don't have it. But if you don't have it, I think it's really cool when you install somebody. The congregation leaders take the pastor by the arm, and they take him to the font, and they say, "We want you to baptize and teach." And then they take him to the reading stand, and say, "Preach the word here," and to the table, you know, feed us and say the prayer here, you know, open our eyes to Christ among us. That's plenty of work for a pastor to do. What I like pairing that with is Gordon Lathrop's that image of strong center. Those things, that's the pastor's responsibility, is to care for baptism, care for preaching and proclaiming the word, care for the prayer around the table and the community's reception of that. The open door is all, if you think about all the processions of the people, the gathering rites, what do the people bring with them? What songs do they bring with them? What hopes? What prayers? Having the people write their own music, that comes in there. It comes in at the offering of the gifts. And then even the sending rite out belongs really to the people. That's all kind of theoretical stuff. Mm-hmm. Some of that... that's another session that I'm not doing this week, but I did before. Never mind. Okay. So...
And what's the last name for Gordon
Lathrop? Gordon Lathrop.
L-A-T-H-R-O-T.
And
okay, I can tell that all of you know that.
His books are in the bookstore.
Books are in our bookstore. Wonderful.
You're great.
So here's some stuff. This is what we do with the prayers. We take most of our time. As some of you have said, that's the most important really thing for the assisting minister. There's a lot of stuff about how we have them do that here.
I want to ask you one thing about that. I noticed this somewhere along the line, and I did mark when it happened, but I noticed that the prayers in the church tend to go, instead of personally addressing God in some fashion, have gone, as you say here, starting for this. So I guess it's pity prayer, isn't it? Where you're giving this kind of thing for the congregation than to say, we pray to the Lord. But it's not, each bid is not directly addressing God in prayer. It's them and the people say, we pray to the Lord.
They can, yeah. Sometimes it's bid, I don't think it has to be necessarily for the leaders of governments, and especially those newly elected, that they may walk humbly with God, doing justice and loving kindness. We pray. It still can be an address to God, but you could also say for the leaders of governments, and people could, you could either have silence or people will pray. But often we'll do the thing with an address to God. This is really kind of the simplest way, and when people are getting started, it's a good way just to say.
Yeah, I was just kind of wondering about that sometimes. Was there some kind of policy that developed in the seminaries?
I think it's been around. I mean, I think it's pretty ancient, but I don't know. One thing I always encourage the assisting ministers not to do is the kind of the help us remember prayers, which are really kind of
50-year-old congregation.
Help us remember that we are all called to give money to the stewardship drive or something like that. It's a little mini lecture disguised as a prayer, and just actually have the guts to ask God to do stuff, you know, and ask us to be called in our life of discipleship to do it too. The other thing, and I'll, this, if you're not familiar with this book, it's kind of church geeky, but it's awesome. Especially if you're Lutheran. It's the commentary on the Lutheran Book of Worship. I'm sorry, that's a fire alarm. We can all stay right here. I don't have to go. I'm going to shut this door. We should stay in here, so let me shut the door. This happens all the time for those of you who don't know. This has stuff that's accessible to lay people that has immense amounts of material about the liturgy and beautiful.
I'm sorry, what is that?
It's called the Commentary on the Lutheran Book of Worship.
And there's one also on occasional service.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Philip Fabricker, and he's got a crazy name. Right? Okay. So I want to go to this last page there. Are there any more questions?
I want to say I've been to occasion when I'm not at home presiding order, where I'm visiting this church, and I know they've taken the prayers verbatim out of the Sundays and Seasons, and it's pretty damn dry. You know, they're not meant to quote.
Do people know the Sundays and Seasons book? Mm-hmm. Sometimes people, you know, they went on a hike and they forgot, what I'll encourage them to do, and it's on the sheet, is just use the word especially. And what's an example? They'll have in there, you know, they write these things 2 years in advance. So for the poor and the impoverished, especially the people served by, you know, the food kitchen in Naaman, you know, across the street. And suddenly, oh, yeah, that's a real prayer. That, but yeah, the canned stuff is not so much rising up from the community. So here's the practical stuff that we put in people's hands here. This assisting minister workshop 3 at the top page. And this is kind of fun. It's just kind of the practices, the very kind of on the ground stuff of how to do it. In terms of speaking your prayers, think about how preaching is stereotyped. You know, you stop preaching at me. It's not a good thing. It's kind of being a windbag. Less is usually more.
I do have a question about that. That's something that we kind of struggle with. Because sometimes we have some of the people and we think we share with them that less is more, but it's like, hello. So what do you do? What do you do?
What we do here is I try to make it so it's not just my job. Is that the whole, like, our Eucharist planning committee and even the whole community at times when we have our community meetings, let's talk about worship and let's get feedback. You know, not especially, how did you like your six prayers, you know? Were your snores registering that you didn't like them? But some people do it, though. There were two people this last winter who did the prayers that lasted forever, but they were good at it. And in spite of myself, I found myself praying through these long petitions. But it worked, and because they're part of the community and we knew them, they got the feedback they needed, and a lot of it was positive. And so, you know, we knew when, you know, this person was going to be assisting minister, we'd be there a while. And we, you know, they talk about the flowers and the mountains and the mountain goats, but it was faithful to this assembly.
I remember a young woman, it wasn't long term, it was just that she was 19 years old, I'm sure it's like that to hear. So her sentence structure wasn't always perfect or something. And I thought, that's not really a big deal. But there were some folks, unfortunately, they didn't say to her, I think it was fortunate. They said to me, you know, like you know, you could do a lot better or something. Mm-hmm. And I think, well, this is wonderful that one of our youth is praying, you know, fussing on it. You know, they were honest prayers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're willing to let them grow that way.
Yes.
And I think, I don't know what to say for larger churches where there isn't that much of a sense of community, because I think it would be more difficult. If it's just some anonymous person up there, we're probably less forgiving than like, I can't
be. In our congregation, the prayers are written by somebody on the intercessory prayer team, and so there's feedback there. We kind of have a standard thing of 3 intercessory prayers. First time I did it, I had 5. It seemed kind of long. Actually, I read them. I wrote them and read them. It seemed kind of long, so that I was back and looking for it. Usually 3. But then they came back and said, but if they're really needed, don't limit yourself to 3. Right.
So you got some good feedback.
Yeah.
I want to try to, it's about 6 o'clock and dinner's at 6:15, so I'm going to kind of blaze through some of this stuff. Just some practical things that I have people think about with voice. I mean, there's a difference between reading and actually doing what you're saying while you're reading. So we talk about that, we practice that stuff, you know.
Now there are some folks of other traditions usually who can, man, rattle off prayers.
Yeah.
Father God, and other people are going, amen, amen, you know, along the way. But typically, it seems to be in our tradition, there's a gentle rate.
What was your question?
So it seems like that's kind of one of your points, is to let it be a prayerful way of saying the words and not the will of God be done.
We do a lot with posture that I think is really helpful, and there's a lot to be said, I think, for our own posture, for our own self spiritually. And have you ever done this when you walk into a worship space, whether it's the preacher going to the pulpit or just the way they're sitting? You can, if the person who's going to be leading worship is looking bored, I mean, how much expectation are you going to have that this service is, you're not going to even put that much into the service. So let our posture express, we come here expecting to meet God face to face. You know, kind of like that Andy Diller thing, into this service could get blown to bits. God may show up. My goodness. In my old church, we had a little ritual with the acolytes where we actually all took off our watches. Mm-hmm. And
only the pastor does that.
Yes, that's right.
We have a clock in the back of our church on the balcony, so it wouldn't work.
Oh, no. Gabe Puck has this great quote, you know, that it's kind of constitutional law. Only a citizen can hold office. And so we do a little bit, he was saying that about people that don't feel like they need to be trained. That if you, until you understand yourself as a servant of this people, you are their servant, you don't hold office. You know, you can stay out there, but you are here to honor and serve these people. So we do some talking about that. Gestures. This is you being the maitre d' or the waiter. The host is always Jesus. We try to get people to use gestures rather than, you know, stand up or sit down or move here or there. Large group, you've heard some of this stuff. Blah, 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 blah. We talk about intent to communicate. And this has been one that's been hard for me to learn, but I heard a guy talk about, you know, sometimes you get this when people are, you know, I'm establishing eye contact, so I'm really connecting with you. But he talks about what you do is when you're talking, you talk to one person for 4 to 6 seconds, and you know that I'm trying to communicate. So all that needs to be communicated is the intent. I'm trying to communicate to people. So people like learning these little things. We've all seen that thing where, like, somebody forgets that they didn't take the thing off the thing at the altar or something, so they're... We run through all this stuff and we practice and say, every time you move, even if it's because you've forgotten something or the Bible is back there and it's supposed to be up here, every time you move, it's a procession. It's a prayer with feet. And so walk with purpose. If you know the big dance, if you know the dance of the Eucharist, you know that you're going to set the table for God's holy people. It's not that you forgot to do it just right. Same thing with kind of setting the table. Just a sense of, just set the table. You don't have to do this perfectly. A lot of kind of little practical things here. I'll wrap up with saying the thing that I end with after we do all these little bitty kind of helpful things is to tell the assisting minister that you will commit to giving them feedback together with the whole assembly. You will not leave them orphaned. They will continue to hear from you. And if they're doing stuff that isn't working or is working, you will let them know. And I always try to just some... Apostolic fathers said always a word of yes and always a word of let's try this. And so always together, I like this and let's try this. And then do it. Follow up with them. Even if you have to, you know, really search, then you get into a habit of exchanging things. And I seek it out from my assisting ministers. You know, tell me how this worked when we did this thing with the splash in the water. Did that seem to work? Mm-hmm. And they can feel honored by that and begin to own their own ministry. I should probably wrap up now. I'll throw a few things out here that I think are all things that lay people can really love and use. If you don't know these LTP source books,
these things are, you know these things?
No.
They're wonderful. Just collections of poetry and songs and quotes. This one, particularly on the Eucharist, this one on liturgy in general, that are just... Sorry?
Who prints them?
LTP, Liturgy Training Publications. It'll be on a sheet that you'll get when you leave the village. LTP also publishes this by Gail Ramshaw, Words Around the Table, which are just kind of devotions on every part of the Eucharist.
Which is one on the font.
And she also has one on the font.
On the font, yeah.
Also, I think, the
fire. Fire, Easter ritual. Great stuff. This one maybe a little less so, maybe a little more outdated. Saving Signs, Wondrous Words, also by LTP, David Philpart. Those are some things that can put into people's hands that I think are, they'll take home and read and begin to get a sense of ownership. Have a wonderful dinner. If you want to hang out, I'll be here for a little while and answer questions or just chat. Thank you.
Thank you.